from KQED.
Support for the California Report comes from the Wesley Foundation, recognizing young social entrepreneurs through the Wesley Prize for Young Innovators of California. Digital Foundry, working with leading organizations to jumpstart digital innovation. More online at digitalfoundry.com. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.
On today's California Report magazine, we'll hear the story of a legendary diner on Route 66 that went up in flames.
I don't want to say it was a curse, but it's almost like it was a curse. It's really strange.
And we'll head to Humboldt County, where boutique cannabis growers are dreaming up plans for how to stay in business if pot becomes legal. Plus, the godfather of Chicano theater reflects on a career born on the farm worker picket lines.
Despite the ugliness, despite the violence, I still believe in people.
I'm Sasha Coca, and this is the California Report magazine. We start the show today with the story of a family farm, the kind of mom-and-pop operation where everybody gathers around the table after the harvest to share a meal. Except this small farm grows marijuana, and the couple that run it are worried about their fate if Prop 64 passes this November, making recreational pot legal. Will it squeeze out the little guys if bigger corporate farms try to make it rich in the green rush, or will there be a boost in business for small farmers like them? Sam Harnett got a rare invitation to visit their pot farm and brings us this story as part of our California Counts election collaboration.
This row is a row of random seed strains.
Crystal Ortiz Beck is showing me her farm, or grow as it's known around here. She's pointing out different cannabis strains she and her husband cultivate for medical marijuana dispensaries.
This greenhouse is all OG Kush. This greenhouse is all Girl Scout cookies.
Crystal's grow is in Holmes, an unincorporated town in Humboldt County, right off the 101. The South Fork of the Eel River drifts through this valley. It's sparsely populated and laced with redwood trees. Like much of Humboldt, marijuana has replaced logging as the main livelihood. Crystal says most of the people here have grown for decades, but they've hidden it, and for good reason.
My family was from northern Mendocino County, and I don't know if I want to go on the record with that.
No, that's
fine. We were raided in the pot wars in 1982.
Crystal says her parents would have never been public about their cannabis. And up until a few months ago, even she would have never grown marijuana out in the open. And she definitely wouldn't have invited an outsider like me to visit the farm. But times have changed.
We're moving into the full sun, out of the trees and out of the shadows and into the full sun.
Crystal's husband, Noah Beck, is dragging a cart through their little farm. It's small, less than an acre, and fenced off from the road. They've got several dozen plants outside and in greenhouses. And this grow is legal. They've gotten permits under new regulations Humboldt established last February. Crystal says young growers like her are embracing this new openness.
Whereas the old timers are like, nope, I remember when the feds came in and they took all the 99 plants in Mendo.
That's Mendocino, another county in the Emerald Triangle of marijuana cultivation. Crystal says many older growers here actually oppose the initiative that would legalize recreational marijuana. They worry Prop 64 will bring costly regulations for how cannabis is grown, and that large corporations will start cultivating, which will drive down the price of marijuana. In the last 15 years or so, Crystal says the price has already fallen from $4,000 a pound to $1,500 a pound.
I think they definitely feel like, you know, Budweiser and Coors and big tobacco and big alcohol coming in are going to, and big ag coming in, are going to wipe us off the map. And I mean, that's a very valid concern.
Hi. Hi, Sam. How are you?
Cool. I'm great. Nice to meet you. Yeah, thanks for having me over.
For sure.
Crystal and her husband, Noah, have a plan to stay in business. And it starts with growing small-batch, organic, high-grade marijuana. Or as they call it, connoisseur cannabis. Noah is spraying his plants. Not with pesticides. Instead, seed oil and Dr. Bronner's soap. Noah loves the cannabis plant. It supports his whole family. He shows me the tiny, hairy flowers on a 6-foot plant.
If these hairs are really looking lush and white and full and thick and sticking up towards the sun, and these leaves are sticking way up and stoked, then I know they're fat and healthy, you know, and the crystal formation is coming on.
Noah says to make a living with marijuana these days, you need to do more than just sell great weed. He and Crystal want to make their farm a destination for tourists, like a vineyard, but for cannabis.
You know, a place where you can sit down and have a nice lunch and, you know, enjoy a smoke, glass of wine, maybe stay the night in a little house.
Bud and breakfast, that's the key name for that.
Right now, Crystal and Noah can't sell their medical marijuana directly to customers, only to dispensaries. Their bud and breakfast dream would be way easier if California voters legalized recreational marijuana, like they may do this fall with Prop 64. Yet, if marijuana is legal, Crystal worries big corporations will get into the business and snuff out the local culture built around cannabis.
I'm not really for the prostitution of the plant. I'm not for the commercialization of the plant.
Crystal says many growers up here are used to a life off the grid. They aren't good at following regulations and working with the law. She fears many won't have the business sense, the money, or the inclination to compete on a larger scale. So, will she vote to legalize?
You know, I would say no, but I'll probably vote for it.
Right.
So only because I feel like some lightning bolt will come down and strike me out of the sky if I vote against legalization.
Give me a plate, sweet pea. Thank you.
At night, Crystal, her husband Noah, their kids, and a few helpers from the farm eat dinner outside on a big picnic table. Then around a campfire, Noah and Crystal pack a bowl and smoke. Someday soon, they hope tourists will be pulling off the highway to come and join them. For the California Report, I'm Sam Harnett in Humboldt County.
That story is part of our California Counts election collaboration. You'll find more of our election stories at californiareport.org. If you've made the drive between Los Angeles and Las Vegas anytime in the last 64 years, you've passed the Summit Inn, an iconic diner, gas station, and gift shop, a rest stop for Hollywood stars and tired motorists, 12 Naugahyde booths, 18 seats at the horseshoe counter, and a jukebox. Last month, it all burned to the ground in the Blue Cut fire.
Very sad night for people who love Southern California history. The fire destroyed the landmark Summit Inn.
Yeah, reporter Peter Gilstrap visited the remains of the inn on the 15 freeway, once a section of historic Route 66.
Near the top of the Cajon Pass, the big red sign with the white block letters announced the Summit Inn against a sky of blinding desert blue. At night, the sign became a blinking neon beacon to countless weary travelers looking for a cup of coffee, a bite to eat, or a place to gas up and stretch their legs.
I saw the flames coming up the hill, and I knew we had to go.
That's Michelle Keeney. She started working at the inn as a teenager and spent the last 24 years there. She's been everything from graveyard shift cashier to, most recently, general manager. The fire took her job, her house, and everything she owned.
I don't want to say it was a curse, but it's almost like it was a curse. It was really strange. Maybe like they're mad that Mr. Stevens was gone. I don't know.
Who's they?
They? The fire gods? I don't know.
The Mr. Stevens she's talking about is Cecil Stevens. He bought the inn on Friday, October 13th, 1966.
Get your kicks on Route 66.
You know, I'm a 66 type of guy. Born on 66, lived on 66, enjoy 66, know a lot about 66. 66 seems to be the key to me. I probably wouldn't even have been up here if it hadn't been for Route 66.
For 50 years at the Summit, Stevens was a boss, a father figure, a tough guy, and a sweetheart. But mostly, he was a man who liked talking to people.
They call it schmoozing or something. I don't know what. But I love talking to movie stars. They come in there a lot. I had Clint Eastwood, and I made him a bet I could beat him in my Pantera. And he had a Porsche or something, and he said, no, I don't want to take your money.
The risk of making bets with Clint Eastwood aside, Driving through the high desert was treacherous, and the Cajon Pass could be a desolate place for travelers.
It's a highway, and they get stranded out there, and they didn't have any way to get out of there. They'd hang around the summit for a week, and they'd sleep out and back and dig in the trash, and it was awful.
The inn was the stage for decades of transient human drama. Heart attacks, drunk drivers, Vegas losers reeking of depression, and road rage. But highway tragedy aside, there were the pancakes, the ostrich burgers, and the regulars. Dave Ellis first ate there as a kid in the 1950s, traveling with his family on Route 66. As an adult, he became a fixture.
I went to the summit every day. If it wasn't for lunch, it would be for breakfast. And then when I first moved up here, I'd go there for dinner a lot, too.
Here's something else about Dave Ellis.
Leave It to Beaver.
I would stand in for Jerry Mathers, the Beaver, on the Leave It to Beaver show.
As the Cleaver family on Leave It to Beaver represented a warm, happy, all-American fiction of a time gone by, the Summit Inn was the real thing, says Michelle Keeney.
The people I worked with, we were like family. It was your work family, but it was family you could depend on if you needed them. It was insanely wonderful.
That wonderfulness is what Catherine Recino Suarez thought she and her mother and brother were buying when they purchased the Summit Inn from Cecil Stevens this past July. At 84, he was ready to retire.
For the first couple of weeks, I was there actually 15 hours a day. And we clicked very, very fast, all of us.
On August 16th, Recino Suarez was running errands in L.A. when she got a warning call from Keeney.
By 3 p.m., she calls me, we're being evacuated. By 6, I was receiving all the pictures of it being burnt down. And I was personally driving, and I pulled over, and I just stopped driving for about 40 minutes because I was just broken inside of me.
Days after the fire, the charred hulk of the inn was fenced off. Then, everything apart from the sign was demolished and removed. But Recino Suarez says they aren't giving up on the place.
We're still in discussions with insurance. Hopefully, crossing fingers, we could rebuild the Summit Inn.
The lingering smell of smoke still hangs in the air where the Summit Inn once stood. The cars and trucks still speed by, but they don't stop anymore. For the California Report, I'm Peter Gilstrap at the Cajon Pass.
Remember the movie La Bamba about Richie Valens, the Chicano rock and roll pioneer from the San Fernando Valley?
Look, this is in Mexico.
Who said it was?
I live there. I understand the tradition of the song. They're always changing the lyrics.
Look, man, I've never even been to Mexico. My music is my music, huh?
You tell him, carnal.
The man who wrote and directed that movie was hanging out with President Obama this week. Luis Valdez was awarded the National Medal of Arts for bringing Chicano and Latino culture to the stage and screen. He got his start not in movies, but performing skits on the back of flatbed trucks. And he's here on the California Report magazine to tell us about his amazing 50-year history in theater. Welcome, Luis Valdez.
Thank you, Sasha.
Your theater company, Teatro Campesino, got its start back in 1965 during the farmworker grape strike in Delano in the Central Valley. And you guys were performing on the picket lines. How did theater help the farmworker movement?
Picket line was basically composed of people standing out in the middle of nowhere, you know, with bullhorns and talking their heads off, you know, all day long. And so the idea of injecting chants and music and even some preliminary actos, we didn't call them skits, we called them actos, in a very rudimentary kind of way on top of flatbed trucks or on top of a panel truck was another way to extend the power of the picket line. And for me, I mean, it gave theater a whole new meaning because it wasn't just for the sake of entertainment, much less the entertaining the bourgeoisie or the well-off. This is for the poorest of the poor.
So you moved your theater from the flatbed truck to the stage with hits like Zoot Suit, which was the first show by a Chicano playwright to ever make it to Broadway. And you turned it into a film, too.
Henry Reyna, my brother.
Henry Reyna.
Our son.
Henry Reyna, my love.
Henry Reyna, el Pachuco, the man, the myth, still live.
So, Luis Valdez, how do you think about Zoot Suit differently now? You're bringing it back to the Mark Taper Forum in L.A. 38 years after it premiered there.
Well, Zoot Suit is like a grandfather, you know, to a lot of Latino plays. It proved that we were box office because the play ran for a year in Los Angeles. It played to almost 500,000 people. That's a phenomenal record anywhere. What it did is that it brought thousands and thousands of Latinos into the theater world who had never seen theater before. And so that opened a lot of eyes. For one, I think it all the regional companies became aware that there's a Latino audience out there and that they're willing to buy tickets if the material suits them.
You were recently named to the Academy that decides the Oscars, which has been criticized for its lack of diversity. What will you be looking for as a member of the Academy?
It's not just a question of actors. All everybody thinks of the actors, get the actors in there, that's it. No, no, you need directors, you need writers, screenwriters, you need producers. You need people in executive positions that can give you the green light and make the thing happen. And if they're not Latinos, at least they should be Latino conscious. And that's always a struggle in Hollywood because it's a question of educating people at every level. We have a ways to go. And despite the ugliness, despite the violence, despite the contradictions of the human race, I still believe in people. I really think that we need to keep moving forward, and the arts make that possible. The way to the human mind is through the heart. And so, as a playwright, one of the things that I strive for is to touch the heart of the audience.
Hmm. Well, you just met President Obama. What did you say to him?
I told him that I did some commercials for him in Salinas in Spanish, you know, when he was running the first time, the primary, because I've been supporting him all these years. I told him I was proud of him and that we're going to miss him. Being in the Obama White House, to me, was like a breath of fresh air, and to see him so eloquent and so alive is an answer to all those years of oppression. But that oppression still exists in agriculture. Farm workers are still wage slaves. And until we change our values, until we stop looking down our noses at the people that grow the food that we all consume, the world will not change.
Luis Valdez is a playwright, writer, director, and actor from San Juan Bautista. And this week, President Obama awarded him the National Medal of the Arts. Another artist with Central Valley roots will be celebrated in Washington, D.C. this month with a National Heritage Fellowship. It's funded by the National Endowment for the Arts and honors traditional and folk artists. Past winners include B.B. King and Bill Monroe, the pioneer of bluegrass. Now a refugee from Laos joins their ranks. Alice Daniel brings us this profile.
The bamboo mouth organ, called the can, is to the Lao what the guitar is to American blues. When Boonsan Sienone plays the can, he is playing nothing less than the sound of home for the Lao diaspora in Fresno and beyond. Sienone sits in a chair in his sparse living room, inhaling and exhaling through the instrument, kind of like one would play a harmonica, so the sound is continuous. Sunny Sanjit Wansa is Sinanone's interpreter.
So you have to use the wind from your mouth. You blow that. There's a hole right here.
See? He points to the can's 16 bamboo pipes.
Blow in there, and each one of these, they have a reed made it out, either copper or a metal.
When Sinanone was 15, he learned to play the can from his uncle and other village elders in Laos. That same year, he lost his eyesight. He says being blind forced him to learn only by ear.
Once he got blind, can't see, then he's playing more and more and learn more, and now he become expert.
An expert who teaches and performs for Lao communities all over the country. His dedication to preserving the tradition of the can is one reason he won a National Heritage Fellowship that includes a $25,000 award. The can is not only a rich solo instrument, it's also used to accompany storytelling in song. Sanjit Wansa, the interpreter, agrees to demonstrate one act from a very long story.
I say, yeah, I tell him the key because I cannot sing the high key, too high. Si papi, si papi.
So Sina Known lowers the key. This song is about an ethnic group called Thai Dom that has to flee its homeland because of all the bombing during the CIA's secret war in Laos. It's a story Sina Known knows all too well. Like many Lao refugees here in the United States, he fled his homeland in the late 70s for Thailand, where he ended up in a refugee camp. In 1981, when he was 32, he came to the U.S.
I was landed in Iowa. I lived there, but there's no Lao people there, but life is not too happy. And it's cold, and there's a snow. And
he lasted about a year in Iowa until friends and cousins in Fresno urged him to move here. Sina Known lives about a half block off a commercial street in a green one-story apartment complex. Outside the building, clothes hang to dry on a metal fence. Toys litter a thirsty lawn. But these signs of ordinary life disappear inside Sina Known's musical home. He plays one of his favorite folk songs. It's called 4,000 Islands. His wife, Kamsuana Keeley, joins us. She says she is very proud of her husband. It makes her happy to hear him play.
It makes her miss the homeland.
She yearns for Laos. And like others who are part of the diaspora, when she hears the can, memories of what she left behind so many years ago come flooding back. Bunsen Sina Known will receive his award at the Library of Congress in Washington later this month. For the California Report, I'm Alice Daniel in Fresno.
And we close out our show today with some tunes to take us into the weekend. Every month, the California Report's Susie Racho checks in with our pop music critic Steve Hockman about the latest releases from artists in the Golden State. Today, they've got music from an experimental hip-hop producer, indie rockers from L.A., and a champion of the Bakersfield sound.
Well, Steve, we've got an eclectic mix of music this time out. Where do you want to start?
Oh, let's start with the Gas Lamp Killer.
The Gas Lamp Killer's new album is called Instrument Telepathy. And with a moniker like that, you'd be right to guess that there's a San Diego connection. William Benjamin Bensessen got his start as a DJ in the Gas Lamp District, but he's also part of a crew of musicians that are all associated with the very hot Brain Feeder label, right, Steve?
Yeah, the label that is sort of pioneered by Flying Lotus, who's one of the real stars of the sort of new music, electro and beyond scene in L.A. here. Yeah, Gas Lamp Killer, he's very much part of that. And he was a real rising star with his first album, Breakthrough, in 2012. But then he flipped his scooter, wound up in the hospital with severe internal bleeding and multiple surgeries, lost his spleen. It took a while for him to really get back into action.
Are there songs on this record that you can tell are influenced by that accident?
Oh, absolutely. Well, the one we were just listening to is called Residual Tingles. I think it's supposed to be like the reminder, this constant reminder of the pain he's had. The whole album kind of feels like it's a combination of those experiences.
That is very cool. It's the Gas Lamp Killer. His new album is Instrument Telepathy. And next we hear the latest from the LA quartet, War Paint. Well, that's an appropriate title. That's called New Song, and that's from War Paint. This is their third album, Heads Up.
Doesn't that have like a really early 80s sort of English pop feel to it, Susie?
It's definitely retro. I read something that it's like they have this range of influences, like everybody from chamber pop to Susie and the Banshees. And
yeah,
I think it's all wrapped up in there.
They've been kind of known, I think, mostly for sort of a darker sound, kind of a very moody, spare sound. And this song, New Song, has sort of a new feel to it. You know, again, new song. They're using that as an analogy, a metaphor for a new relationship as well. But it's also for a new phase for the band, these four young women from Los Angeles. Their third album, they have generated a lot of buzz with their previous two albums. Maybe it's going to be a big break for them. Maybe this is one where people see the full capabilities of War Paint.
Is War Paint, and their new record is Heads Up. And we just have a minute here. We're going to end today with a familiar name who's back with a familiar song.
Now heads, guitars, Cadillacs, and hillbilly music. Lonely, lonely street I call home. Hear my guitar.
So if you are a fan of Dwight Yoakam, you know that that's Dwight Yoakam doing Dwight Yoakam. So what's going on here, Steve?
Well, more than 30 years ago, Dwight Yoakam came out from Kentucky via a try at Nashville. It didn't go so well, but he came out to Hollywood and got here and kind of led that wave of new California country. 30 years later, he revisits it. Now, this album is called, I love the title, Swimming Pools, Movie Stars. He's...
For those who don't know, you need to go back and watch your Beverly Hillbillies for that reference.
He's definitely playing up the Beverly Hillbillies angle here with a wink, which is what he does really well. He's from Kentucky. He's doing bluegrass and acoustic country, old-timey country on this album, and he's got Purple Rain.
Dwight Yoakam's new record is Swimming Pools, Movie Stars, and Steve Hoffman is the California Report's pop music critic. He has more on the releases from Dwight Yoakam, War Paint, and The Gaslamp Killer at californiareport.org. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Susie.
And that's the California Report magazine, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our technical producer is Seal Muller, with additional engineering from Howard Gelman. Our team includes Eli Wortschafter, Lacey Jane Roberts, David Marks, Vinnie Tong, Victoria Maulione, Polly Stryker, Susie Racho, Ingrid Becker, Ethan Lindsay, and Holly Kernan. I'm Sasha Coca. Thanks for listening. This is the California Report magazine.
Support for the California Report comes from the California Endowment, working to achieve health and justice for all. Learn more at calendow.org. The James Irvine Foundation, expanding economic and political opportunity for Californians who are working but struggling with poverty. More at irvine.org. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.